Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Chicka 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 Slim Shady, I'm sick of him. Look at him walking around grabbing his you-know-what, flipping the you-know-who.
Yeah, but he's so cute though.
Yeah, I probably got a couple of screws up in my head loose, but no worse than what's going on in your parents' bedrooms. Sometimes I wanna get on TV and just let loose, but can't. But it's cool for Tom Green to hump a dead moose. My bum is on your lips, my bum is on your lips. And if I'm lucky, you might just give it a little kiss. And that's the message that we deliver to little kids.
Make sure it's natural. Yeah.
We're rolling. So absolutely. I'm podcasting with Tom Green.
Yeah, this is great. This is a nice little recording studio you have here.
Thank you very much, Tom.
Thank you for having me on the show.
It's an honor. For me as a kid growing up, you were, for me and many other people, I think, of my generation, a real pioneer of broadcasting.
Yeah. What generation would that be?
So 86 was when I was born.
1986.
So I guess kind of mid to late 90s was my peak teen years when I'm discovering music, movies, comedy, and my personality's forming.
So I would have come in late 90s for you.
You'd have come in late 90s, Tom Green Show. I guess I discovered that when it was on TV in the UK. And would 99 be right?
99, yeah.
Yeah.
How old were you in 1999?
14. So
14 years old. Okay,
perfect age.
Perfect age for my show.
Yeah.
Yeah. Perfect maturity level.
Yeah.
Yeah, for the Tom Green Show.
But now, obviously, anyone could perhaps have the at least the technological capabilities to do what you were doing.
Yeah.
Then, not so much. Like, you had to have a directional journalistic microphone.
You've got more technology on this table here, probably.
Do you think
so? Than we had for the show. Well, I guess there's not a camera. Well, there is. There's the iPhone there.
Yeah.
Yeah, probably more technology on this table than we had for the show.
And before that, what were you doing? What was your sort of way into comedy? Was it stand-up to begin with?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, I did college radio. And a bunch of stuff like that, yeah. And I did, I was in school, I was studying broadcasting. So that's where I got into the video side of things. And I was doing stand-up comedy, yeah.
So it was all kind of all there from the start. And music as well, were you kind of turned on to
music
early on?
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. Yeah, so I was doing music. I was making music in my home recording studio, making rap beats. And it was a lot of fun.
So what kind of technology did you have to do that back in the 90s? Because you couldn't have just used your laptop.
I did. I had keyboards and samplers and drum machines. So I had an Akai S900 sampler.
Right.
And an Akai S950 sampler. I had a Roland U20 keyboard. I had a Tascam 4-track with a Simpty track time code running on it, so I would sync all the electronics together with a time code click track, and then I would sync that up to an Atari computer.
Wow.
And that was basically my sequencer.
Uh-huh.
And I would just record the vocals onto tape.
Who were your guys from the hip-hop world that were releasing records that had an impact on you?
Public Enemy, Tribe Called Quest.
So the classics.
The Beastie Boys, like On Your Jacket. Run DMC. You know, all sorts of stuff like that. Early hip-hop.
The pioneers, right?
Yeah.
And then later on, was it for the Freddy Got Fingered movie? Originally, you teamed up with Mike Simpson? Or was the hip-hop record pre that film? Because he produced your hip-hop album as well, didn't he?
Yes.
But you also scored
for Freddy Got Fingered. I teamed up with Mike Simpson. He did the soundtrack for Freddy Got Fingered, who I met from Road Trip. So really, I was really introduced to Mike Simpson through through the movie Road Trip.
And what was that like for you as a kid growing up? You know, I guess Paul's Boutique might have been one of the albums that was top of your list of favorites.
That was that one and License to Ill were my favorites. Right, I'd say Paul's Boutique was my favorite, actually.
Yeah, and completely. That was the one the Dust Brothers did, right?
That was the one the Dust Brothers did. Because I just loved all the samples. Because that was the way I made music, sampling and looping. I would go down to the college station and just raid the jazz and funk and R&B records and just sample everything onto a digital audio tape recorder. And then I would take the DAT recorder home to my house and I would sample off of that onto my samplers.
It's a more creative time. And maybe that extends to like instrumental rock music as well. I feel like now everything is available. There isn't that same problem-solving creativity that people had in the early days, say 60s, 70s, and then 80s. It sort of peaked, I guess, with hip-hop and sampling. But would you agree with that? Or
I'm actually feeling more creative now, or as creative now as I was then.
But maybe from like a musical standpoint, I guess.
Well, you know, I just think that it's different, that's all. I mean, if you say that, you know, technology is... I know what you're saying, obviously. I agree with you. But I don't like to...
It's not the enemy of creativity.
I don't like to think of Pro Tools as the end of music.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, because we can go in and have, you know, as many tracks, infinite number of digital tracks at our disposal that we're now going to not think of anything new. It does make things a lot easier to record, but... I think that ultimately, at the end of the day, it's still content over form, is what Mike Simpson told me, actually, from the Dust Brothers. It's not really about how you record it. It's about the idea.
And the end result, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
It's about the idea. So, you know, but I will say that it is a big part of the reason why I've gone full force into doing stand-up comedy, because I believe that stand-up comedy, there are no technical... tricks. It's you and an audience, and there's no gadgetry involved. You know, you can do on your iPhone everything that you need to do to make a television show, like the Tom Green Show in 1999. I mean, if you go on my Instagram, you can see all these videos that I'm shooting and editing now that I'm shooting and editing on my iPhone.
Is that what you shoot on now, your iPhone?
Well, just for Instagram.
Yeah.
But the technology on there is...
high-end, right?
You know, you can shoot a video in 10 minutes and cut it together and have...
Do you edit on the phone as well?
It's just for my Instagram.
Right.
I'm shooting a documentary right now, and I'm doing that with regular editing software and
what's
shooting.
The premise of that? Like a road tour movie, is it?
A tour movie, yeah. About this tour that's taken us from all across Israel and Amsterdam and all through the UK. So, yeah, that... But I'm just saying that... I think I said it. Yeah, you know, I'm just saying that, you know, it's gotten so much easier to make videos that everybody's doing it, and in that sense, it kind of makes it a little bit less. Thank you. We're having cups of coffee right now.
Cheers, Tom.
Cheers.
Real pleasure, man. Real pleasure.
Thank you. Cheersing with coffee and water. Coffee. Hey, Michael, can you close that door? Just thanks. Yeah. Thanks. It just makes me nervous. With the door open, I get nervous. Feel like people are listening, you know, which obviously is the whole point of this.
That's the end game,
you
hopefully.
You want people to listen.
But not right now. We need intimacy, don't
not
we?
Not right now. I just want to talk to you right now, as if there's nobody listening.
Tell me about some of the broadcasters that maybe inspired you from either a radio or television standpoint when you were starting out, when you were young, when you were experimenting.
Well, David Letterman was the number one inspiration for sure. I mean, as far as... traditional, I know he probably wouldn't like to think of himself as traditional because he was such a groundbreaking pioneer of
the talk show,
irreverent late night talk. But he was on NBC, so for as far as being somebody that was working within the traditional media, David Letterman was my hero. But I also got so much inspiration from, like we talked about, hip hop music. From rap videos, from skateboarding videos. That was probably equal parts inspiration for the Tom Green Show. So it didn't all just come from me wanting to replicate David Letterman. It came from me wanting to make gorilla-type skateboard videos stuff that didn't look like it deserved to be on television or should be put on television. That was always the rawness that I liked from the early years of that stuff. So
was that kind of the driving force, was to not be shocking for the sake of being shocking, but to almost cut straight through and get people's attention?
Yeah, well, the driving force was I loved making videos, and I was desperate to not get a job, a real job.
I'll drink to that.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. It was this sort of kind of real fear of having to grow up and actually go out into the traditional workforce and work in a real corporate job to support myself. And so I really was looking for a loophole, a way around that.
Same.
And, yeah, and that's I think, what...
Did you enjoy school? Did you fit in with the academic mold?
I did not enjoy the academic side of school. I mean, I was a very good student until high school. Then I became distracted by extracurricular things like making music and doing stand-up comedy. And
well, you were doing comedy in high school.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, I started.
Were you playing like over 18 or over 21 adult clubs? Or
I was playing at the comedy club in Ottawa. Yuck Yucks. Wow. Yeah, yeah.
That's a fierce attitude to have at a young age. Was it scary being in front of adults, or was it almost less so because you knew you could be more irreverent?
It was more scary then, because you didn't have any reference point,
right?
Of what adult you should life. Be talking about it. Yeah, exactly. I had no. I mean, I started doing stand-up comedy before I'd, had sex. I don't want to look at you while I say that, because you're sitting right
he
there.
He did notably turn away then
weird,
as well.
A weird thing to talk about.
Like the thought. Just
but, you know, so you're on stage talking about funny observations and, you know, you've never really experienced life, so...
Talking about your paper round or something. Or
yeah, stuff like that. Talking about funny TV commercials and... Uh-huh. Goofy things that happened at school, and it was sort of a novelty for the first couple of years. But I was pretty tall kid. I was 6 foot, I was 6'3" when I was 16 years old. So it wasn't like I was some little kid standing there.
At what age did you get the goatee as well? Because I always remember you having that.
When I was around 17 or 18, I started that.
That's pretty early too.
Yeah, after I got that after I started doing stand up. That was came little later, you know. I think people associate me with the goatee. You've got a goatee.
I know, it's not in tribute to you. I've kind of raised an awkward.
Yeah.
Facial feature
people
about
associate
myself
me with that though. So I haven't had a goatee in over 10 years, but anytime I do have a goatee, people recognize me a lot more.
Right.
I think that might be partly why I have the beard.
Out, yeah.
It's nice to be able to walk around and not constantly be talking about
I saw a moment ago you tweeted a little picture from just by the bull ring.
What's that?
I saw a moment ago you just tweeted a little picture of you just hanging out by the bull ring up there, and obviously it's good that you can do that. Just mingle in the cities that you're staying in and
that was taken from the car.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. I just took that out the window as we drove past. Yeah. But
it's a
pretty
looking building, isn't it? This is my hometown, and it's a monstrosity, I think.
Yeah, it's a weird building. I liked it.
Isn't it?
We drove into town. What is that building?
It's like a shopping precinct, like a mall.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah.
It's a nice-looking mall. It looks like it's sort of like built to withstand an asteroid attack or something. Yeah.
So when you're doing all these things, so you're doing stand-up comedy, you're making hip-hop, you're making videos, what starts taking off first?
Well, I guess it was the rap group. I got a record deal when I was 19 years old. I'd been doing stand-up for about, 4 years or something like that, 3 or 4 years. And we got this record deal in Canada with my group Organized Rhyme. And I actually quit doing stand-up and I went and pursued the music and toured with the band and did that for a couple of years.
Who did you play with? Did you get to do any
big
shows? We played
mostly on our own, but we did a couple of big shows with the Bare Naked Ladies.
Really?
Who
amazing.
Were a huge band in Canada at the time. They hadn't broken in the U.S. yet. But
I didn't even realize they were a Canadian band.
Yeah, they're from Toronto, and we were from Ottawa, and that was kind of very exciting for us because we got to play in big stadiums and things like that a couple of times with them. But for the most part, we just did our own shows. And
all over Canada or just in the
Sort of in the local area. We went did a show down in New Jersey once, which was pretty cool, with Third Base.
Right.
Never actually got to meet Third Base, but we went down and opened for them.
And, do they know that now? Are they aware?
Think they know that, no. I don't think they know. They were playing at Rutgers University in New Jersey, and we drove down and were one of a couple of acts that opened for them. And we did weird stuff, though. I think they would have appreciated what we were doing. We brought laundry baskets, and at mid-show, we would put laundry baskets on our head and just start doing this slow, synchronized rotation.
Which you've probably never audience, seen at a hip-hop show before.
Yeah, and the whole audience was an all-black audience in New Jersey, everyone coming out to see, you know, a rap concert, and, you know, literally... you know, the other guy in the group and I were like the only white kids there, you know, and we were on stage with laundry baskets on our head. And people loved it because I think we weren't really like trying to look hardcore. You know, we weren't hardcore. We were two goofy kids from Ottawa. But I think the fact that we kind of kept it real like that, and our beats were dope, you know what I'm saying? Word. We had like really serious hip hop beats, so and we could rap, so it was kind of it went over well.
What were you doing lyrically? Were you doing sort of funny tongue in cheek stuff? Was it serious? Was it surreal?
Yeah, it was just literally the same songs that you can go listen to on YouTube right now. It was kind of us trying to be like the Beastie Boys,
right?
Just not as good, yeah, you know. Yeah.
Well, that's a pretty high standard to set the.
Yeah,
the
I mean
up.
We love. I mean, I would say that we didn't listen to the Beastie Boys exclusively. I mean, I was more into Public Enemy and Tribe Called Quest, but
because you're white, that's the obvious comparison, right?
Yeah.
Do you get compared a lot to Andy Kaufman? Because I know stylistically, there's a lot of differences, but there's also a lot of similarities.
This is an odd thing, but I'd never heard of Andy Kaufman. Until
right now,
the Man on the Movie. Yeah, right now. Until right now. No, when the Man on the Moon movie came out.
What a movie that is.
And I was actually going through cancer at the exact same time as the Man on the Moon movie came out, which was about Andy Kaufman getting cancer. I know it seems odd to think that I didn't know Andy Kaufman, but I just didn't. It was just, I think it was very American comedy. I mean, he... just sort of, and I was too young for it, you know. I was just before the time of Andy Kaufman, you know. I mean, I watched the show Taxi, but I never really liked that show.
No.
And when I think about it in hindsight, I go, oh, I guess I remember that guy from Taxi, but I don't really remember him being on Taxi all the time. And I never really watched Taxi. Taxi was one of those shows that was always on TV, but I never watched it because it was from 10 years before I understood what it was and what they were talking about. I was born in, you know, I mean, probably peak Andy Kaufman years, I was probably 10 years old.
Right.
So I was a little too young for it. But
it's interesting you should say that you got cancer at the time that movie came out, though, because that, I think, is something he would do in the same way that you did that Tom Green cancer
special.
Oh, yeah.
Everyone was coming up to me saying, oh, is this like an Andy Kaufman thing? Do you not really have cancer? Are you pulling a prank on us? This is a joke. And then, but let me say, in you know, retrospectively, as soon as I found out who Andy Kaufman was, the other thing was the first time I heard about Andy Kaufman was just a little before that. We did a bit on my show in Canada before MTV. It was right before MTV, where I drove the entire audience home from the show. After the show, I went out to the audience. We had these spray guns, and I sprayed the entire audience down with water. And soaked the entire audience completely without telling them that we were going to do it. And it was in the middle of winter, and it was freezing out.
In Canada.
And nobody could leave, and they were soaked. And people couldn't believe we did it. And I can't believe we got away with that. And it was probably one of the meaner things that I've ever done on my show. But everybody, it didn't really come off mean anyways, because people were so excited to be there, getting sprayed down randomly, that everyone was laughing. The audience was laughing as they were getting soaked. And then after the show, everyone said, well, how can we leave? And we said, well, we've got a bus for you. We're going to drive you all home. You don't have to walk through the cold. So then we spent the whole night driving the audience home. And people were getting mad. It was taking forever to drive the audience home. I remember at the end of the night, somebody said to me, hey, that's like an Andy Kaufman thing where he took the audience home for milk and cookies.
I saw you got milk and cookies. Yeah.
I'd never heard of that bit before, and I just thought, wow, that sounds cool. But it was just a mention. It was the only time I ever heard a mention. And, you know, I remember thinking, yeah, sure, it's like an Andy Kaufman thing. Like, I don't know who that is, but no, it's not like an Andy Kaufman thing. Nobody's ever sprayed the audience down with water before in the middle of winter and drove them home in a bus. You know, I was in my head thinking, you know, we were so much more outrageous than anybody could possibly have been before us, you know, is what my mind was thinking. But we really were kind of pretty cocky kids, you know. When we came up to the show, we thought we were doing stuff that no one had ever done before. So when anyone ever suggested that somebody had done something similar, I would always kind of close my mind off to that and say, no, I doubt it. I doubt it. But turned out he did drive the audience out for milk and cookies on a bus. And when the movie came out a couple years later, I think it was when I moved to New York to do the show on MTV, a lot more people started mentioning Andy Kaufman. I just think he was a lot more well-known in the United States. And so then I started looking into who Andy Kaufman was. Remember the first time I met Jim Carrey, it was right when the movie was coming out. And the very first thing he said to me was, he said, hey, I like your show. Do you like Andy Kaufman? And I still didn't know who he was, really, and I sort of did now, and I just kind of said, yeah, I like Andy Kaufman. I knew the movie was coming out. I didn't want to say I didn't like Andy Kaufman to Jim Carrey, who just spent, you know, he's
he went method in that role, didn't he?
Yeah,
he is absolutely. So good in that role.
I think that was actually probably when the first time I heard of Andy Kaufman was when I heard about him. I heard about Jim Carrey doing the – I was in Toronto shooting – I was in a small role in the movie Superstar. It was right before the show got picked up by MTV. And I heard that Jim Carrey was shooting Man on the Moon about Andy Kaufman. And everyone was talking about Andy Kaufman. And I guess Jim Carrey had done, you know, a wrestling sketch where he made everyone believe that he actually broke his neck on the set of the movie, which is a total Andy Kaufman thing. Yeah. And it was a news story that Jim Carrey had hurt his neck filming the movie, and everybody was talking about it. That was when I really first really, really knew who Andy Kaufman was. But anyways, regardless of not knowing about him when everybody else did, I went back and studied Andy Kaufman afterwards and looked at everything I could look at of his, went down to the Museum of Television and Radio in Los Angeles, watched all of his shows, watched his pilot for his talk show, And everything that he's done, I've seen now, and I love Andy Kaufman.
That Tony Clifton character for me is one of my favorite comic creations ever. Mm-hmm. And again, not to kind of draw on that similarity, but there's definitely for me a parallel between the MC face and yourself and that hateful relationship between that character and you. And that's obviously what Andy Kaufman did with Tony Clifton, is you never see the two of them in the same room. And
yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I love it. I love it. It was incredible. It's you know, I sometimes think that, I mean, as many Andy Kaufman fans do, I really sometimes hope that it is a big prank and that he's not that he didn't pass away from cancer and that he's going to come back someday and surprise everybody.
We can hope. Can I get real with you for a second, Tom?
Yeah, sure. Yeah.
At that point,
what
in time,
has it been up till now? Has it been fake up till now?
This has been like the first course.
Yeah.
Now I want to go straight to the main because I know you're tired and I don't want to keep you for long.
Yeah, it's okay, yeah.
And I want to ask you a personal question about what happened with your illness because about 3 years ago I broke my spine.
Ouch.
Three places.
Oh my gosh.
Was in hospital for 3 months.
Okay.
Like 8 hours away from death. It was gnarly.
Wow.
And in that moment.
Sorry to hear that.
It changed my outlook and perspective on life.
Yeah.
So much. And it got me thinking about, in the lead up to this conversation, you at that point in time when you were probably like the peak of your fame and popularity, right, was exactly when you got sick.
Yeah, it was.
What a crazy whirlwind to be in anyway, healthy, and then that comes into the mix. How did that affect you at the time, and what did that experience teach you, do you think, now looking back at it? Because it was such a brave, raw, vulnerable thing you did filming it all in the way that you did as well.
Yeah, I mean, it was just
and so inspiring.
It was a really horrible horrible timing. I mean, it's never good timing to get cancer, but that was probably the worst time to get cancer, regardless, because the show was on MTV. It's why I stopped doing the Tom Green Show. You know, people don't know that. I mean, generally people don't know that the show was the number one show on MTV, and I quit, you know, at the peak of the show's popularity to go deal with my cancer. And then when I finished with my cancer, I had several movie offers, and, you know, I'm like, it's hard to sit here and complain about how horrible of a time it was when I had, you know, four movie offers lined up, and I went from my cancer surgery right onto the set of Saturday Night Live, where I was hosting SNL, and then went from movie set to movie set to movie set for the next 2 years, you know, shooting films and doing incredibly well. It's hard to sit here and complain, oh no, what a bad time to be sick. I mean, it sucked because it's extremely painful physically and emotionally. It's very, very scary to think that you could be confronting death. But at the same time, you know, it taught me that you can battle through horrible things that you would never expect, and still not let it destroy you. And it also makes you very aware that that life is fragile, and you have to be positive and enjoy and cherish every moment that you have. Not to sound cheesy, but it really does kind of come to the forefront of your mind. You know, like I'll have on a daily basis something pop into my head where I think to myself, you know, at least I'm not in the hospital today. You know, if I'm having a bad day and something bad has happened, something that, you know, if I had not been through that experience, it would be like a really big deal and I'd be really upset. But, you know, I'll be walking down the sidewalk thinking about some horrible thing, supposed horrible thing that just happened. And I can just think, well, you know, at least I'm not in the hospital right now with tubes running into my spine and on morphine and fighting cancer. You know, it could be so much worse. And so it's really hard now to get really, really, really upset about little things that would have been big things if I had not been through that. So it's been a positive experience overall. I say in my show, one of my jokes is, I say, sometimes I think about my battle with cancer and I think I wouldn't trade it for anything, but then I think, actually, no, I'd trade it for my right testicle. I wouldn't mind getting that back. But it is true. I do think that I probably gained more than I lost, you know, from the cancer experience. I mean, they just took the right testicle. I mean, it's no big deal. I still got the other one. It's fine. I still have the left one. It's the middle one now. I'm doing my jokes now. But it was a good thing. I took a lot away from it that was and ended up being positive.
As a comic performer, what did the experience teach you about the meaning of humor in terms of its role in this world? And also, I guess, because you're quite a physical performer, did it slow you down or make you change your approach in any way? Because when you perform physically and then something like that happens, it's never too far from your mind for a while, is it?
Well, it was the reason why I stopped doing the Tom Green Show, because I didn't have the sort of... First of all, I've been doing the Tom Green Show at that point for probably almost 10 years. Maybe 7 years, which when you're in your 20s feels like 20 years. You know, it was my whole adult life. You know, I started doing that kind of stuff when I was, you know, even before the Tom Green Show. I'd been doing it for 10 years, running around on the streets doing pranks, right? So I didn't want to go out and get into confrontational situations with people anymore because I was in a lot of physical pain from having my, you know, I had a lymph node dissection, so it was more than just a minor surgery. I had to remove like my lymph nodes from the back of my spine. It was a massive surgery. It took me years and years and years to recover from it. I still actually feel physical effects of it, you know, as far as, you know, pain issues and things like that. But, you know, for the first couple of years, there was no way I wanted to go running around on the streets and getting chased by security guards and things like that.
It's so
that
not was, your goddamn business where I'm going.
Yeah, exactly. I just didn't want to get into confrontations with people.
Yeah.
And I also had done the show for so long that I was kind of wanting to try something new. So I stopped doing the show and started doing films and has it affected me physically now? I mean, my show is very high energy now, so I would say no.
Do you think there's more pathos in your material?
But yeah, exactly. I knew there was a question I was forgetting. That's why I was trying to remember what the question was. Yeah, well, like I said, it's exactly what I was just talking about, you know, about being valuing the you know, every day and staying positive and, you know, being in the moment and not worrying about the small stuff. All of that translates into my comedy and I also think a lot about you know, just how fragile life is. I do a lot of material that's very dark in my stand-up show. I talk a lot about death. I talk a lot about morbid subjects, which to me is cathartic, because if you can laugh at dark, morbid subjects, then it helps me personally cope with this sort of very present fear that I have of the end looming for all of us. I do think about that way more than the average person, because I've been right there, you know, on the edge of it, on the precipice of death. I've stared it in the face. I've been in that hospital bed. The kid beside me who had the same thing I had, you know, the 24-year-old kid who had the exact same testicular cancer that I had, he died. You know, I didn't die, you know. He was a fan of my show. I remember the doctor said, you know, the kid in the room next to you is a fan of the show. And I went over and I said hello to him and had a nice chat. And a year later, he was dead and I was alive. So, you know, he had the exact same thing that I had, you know. So it makes you realize just how fragile and everything is, and it makes you want to joke about it. So I think that's had an impact for sure. I wouldn't joke about that as much, for sure. I wouldn't think about life in those terms if I had not had cancer. So, yeah.
Did that with your parents and the way you've always filmed a lot of your life? Did you prep them early on? Did you include them as the comedy and the career developed? And then just specifically with that cancer special, I mean, were they privy to all of those decisions with you? And did you very much respect the wishes of the people around you, your loved ones?
I didn't. I mean, they were on the show.
Yeah, yeah. That's what I mean.
The cameras were pointing at them. But they were at this point used to being on camera because I'd done a lot of pranks. And they knew I was in L.A. doing the show. So, you know, when I decided to, I don't think I ran it past them, but we looked at it like an, you know, sort of a, you know, I mean, there was a moment where I said, hey, let's film this. You know, our whole staff had moved from New York City to Los Angeles. People had given up apartments. People had given up, you know, their lives in New York and moved out to L.A. because the show was doing so well. They assumed that we were going to be on the air for a few more years in L.A. And it was just a couple of months after we got to L.A. I had to stop the show. And so we thought, okay, well, here will be one last show we can do, as opposed to coming in and sending everyone home. This is another month, at least, for people to film, another couple of months. And it wasn't really the reason we did it, but it was, you know, we were in the middle of production, so we had the whole crew there. You know, it was kind of easy to say, hey, let's turn the cameras around on me, you know. It wasn't something that MTV instantly agreed to do. We had to actually really, really lobby them to let me film it. And eventually they did. I mean, it wasn't like they thought about it for weeks or anything, but they didn't say yes right away. And we had to push for them to let me do it. Then the special that's aired on MTV, you know, many times doesn't air anymore, but when it did air at the time, it raised so much awareness for testicular cancer that now here, 15 years later or more, 17 years later, I've got people coming to my shows, you know, at least once a week, somebody comes up to me after one of my shows and says that the reason they diagnosed their cancer was because of that, especially in the United States, because MTV was so in rotation. The show, that cancer special played on MTV, you know, probably 100 times, you know, over the course of the months after I was diagnosed with cancer. And so many young teenage boys who would have never gone to the doctor went to the doctor because of that. And that's when you get testicular cancer, when you're, you know, 15 to 35 years old. So it was prime viewership for MTV. So all of these kids went to the doctor. Many of them didn't have cancer, but went anyways because they thought they had it. But so many people, like, I don't know how many, but it must have been, you know, I mean, tens of thousands of people must have. I've had letters from at least I've had at least 1,000 people have come up to me and said that the show saved their life over the last 10 years. It's surreal. I don't think anyone really knows that. I don't think I've ever even really said it like that. I mean, I've told people come up to me all the time, but it's actually got to be close to 1,000 people now have actually come up to me and told me. So I can't imagine how many people actually, you know, went to the doctor because of it and haven't told me, you know.
So what an amazing legacy.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. I think MTV should air that show every year, you know, but you know, I don't know. It's interesting. You know, television's changed, and you know, it was all shot on like 4:3 aspect ratio, and like
I watched it on YouTube last night. Yeah. And it's like a square, isn't it?
Yeah.
People can view it. It's the Tom Green Cancer Special on YouTube. It's easy and accessible on there.
Yeah.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Going back to your parents in the early days, was there ever any sort of like fallout with them? Because it's quite a brave decision to put so much of your life on camera, isn't it?
No, there's not really. I mean, there was a little bit. There's times where they got angry and stuff. But they, you know, I mean, they never sued me or anything.
No.
They got really angry, you know. They got really angry. But in hindsight, they're happy about everything. I mean, I've done very well, and they're happy that I've now touring the world. And I talk to my mother every couple of days, and I get emails from my parents, my mom and dad. Every you know, the Guardian wrote a nice article about me yesterday, and I got a nice email from my dad this morning saying, you know, great article. You know, so they're very supportive parents, you know. I mean, I think the thing that I'm most excited about is what I'm doing now with my stand-up is, you know, is that I found that I have now finally, for the very first time in the last few years, even more so than when I was on MTV and everything was, you know, I feel like I have much more control over my career now than I've ever had. You know, I'm able to perform around the world. I don't have a network that can cancel me or say or take away what I'm doing. So I'm not living under this sort of this blanket of fear. Like when you have a TV show, you're in fear because
especially if it's successful.
Yeah, because the ratings go down and then the network cancels you.
Yeah.
Or if you say something wrong, the network cancels you. Where, as with stand-up comedy, it's completely independent. And I feel, for that reason, so much more in control of my life than I've ever felt. And that's why I love what I'm doing right now. I'm not really even out there actively chasing films or TV shows. I have a TV show in development, and that's something that is exciting to me, but it's not my main focus, I guess. It's definitely a priority. I'd love to do a TV show that I'm writing a TV show right now that I'm excited about. But it's interesting, like now I want to get this TV show on the air because it will help build my stand-up comedy, you know, not the other way around. You know, it's, I don't want to do stand-up comedy so I can get a TV show. I want to get a TV show so I can continue doing stand-up comedy. So it's sort of a promotional mechanism for my stand-up shows. You know, get a TV show and more people will come see me do stand-up, which is really my first love and now what I love to do. And, you know, and the freedom to be able to get up on stage and say whatever you want, talk about things that are completely absurd and ridiculous, that you don't have to run past some person who is approving every line. When you do a TV show, every single moment of that show, doesn't matter how edgy the show is, you can look at any show on TV. You know, it's been run through executives and writers, and yeah, sure, things eventually come out and they're pretty funny and great and all of that stuff. But the process of making it is not...
It's laborious, right?
It's not just coming from the mind of one person. It's coming from the mind of a whole team of people. So in order to make a great TV show, which is a fun and amazing thing to do, the process is more about building a team of 100 people who can work well together to come up with this collective idea. But you're not really... You know, when you're watching your favorite comedian on a TV show, you're not really watching what's coming out of his mind. You're watching what came out of the 100 people that worked together to make this thing. Whereas when you're watching a stand-up comedian, you're watching that person that you love, and you're watching what's coming out of their mind. And that's what I love about stand-up. That's why I love watching stand-up. It's unfiltered, and doing what I'm doing now, it's sort of what I always wanted. You know, the reason why I got into doing the TV show in the first place was because I didn't want to have a boss. I didn't want to have to go to work. And I think that was the most disappointing thing when I ended up on MTV was we had executives there telling us what to do and what not to do and when to do it. And it was exactly what I was trying to avoid. You know, I was trying to avoid having this authority in my life. And so with stand-up comedy, there's none of that. You know, you're in business for yourself. You got to make sure you show up to the venue. You got to meet people and do interviews and promote your show and all of that. But it's you that's putting pressure on yourself. It's not someone else putting pressure on you.
And you can pick and choose and say, yeah, no, yeah, okay, maybe, no, yeah.
Exactly. I said, you know what? I want to do your show. You know,
thank
that's
you,
why
Tom.
I'm here. You know,
thank
I
want to.
Nobody made me do this. You know, so. I appreciate you coming down talking to me today. Yeah, thank you, because, you know, it's good. I understand you have, like, millions and millions of people that listen to your podcast, so that's going to be amazing for me in the United Kingdom when millions and millions of your listeners maybe find out who I am for the very first time. I appreciate it.
We'll see how the sales do for the next tour.
Yeah.
And then if it works out good, we'll have to do another, right?
Absolutely.
Can we talk movies real quick, or do you want to get off? You can say you do want to get off if you do.
Yeah, real quick. I mean, what, my movies?
Yeah, I just wanted to ask you about your experience of making Freddy Got Fingered, because for me, that's a hugely important cult film that I think has been reappraised in the way that it deserves since when it first came out.
Uh-huh.
I just wanted to know about your experience making it, and then if there's perhaps any more in the pipeline.
Well, I'm in a movie that's coming out next year called Iron Sky. It's a sequel to this movie, Iron Sky. It's called Iron Sky 2.
The sequel.
Yeah, the sequel. And I play a really weird character in that. Like I said, I don't really chase down movies, but I am actually shooting a documentary right now, which is a feature-length documentary about my stand-up comedy tour that I'm on right now. So it's going, you know, there's the camera... director and camera guy who I'm traveling with is here in the hotel. He's not filming at this moment, but we'll be filming tonight, and that's going to be good. So people will be able to watch that. And And, you know, yeah, it's amazing. Like, you know, Freddie Got Fingered has always had, like, a huge fan base. The only reason people think that it doesn't is because it was, I guess, kind of cool to write that it was an unsuccessful movie. The movie's not unsuccessful. The movie is a financial success. You know, you can read any article about me, and they say, you know, the article that came out yesterday in a newspaper, I won't name the newspaper because I don't like throwing writers under the bus for getting their facts wrong. But, you know, the article, an article that came out yesterday here in the United Kingdom, not the Guardian article, but another article, called the movie a financial, you know, bomb. It wasn't a financial bomb. The movie made money. It cost $14 million to make. It made $14 million in 3 days over its opening weekend.
Done.
And then it made $35 million on DVD. So it's a huge financial success, more than most movies. You know, most movies that cost $150 million to make, and then they make $150 million, and everyone says it's a success, but they broke even, you know? So there's movies that lose massive amounts of money. Most movies lose money. But Freddy Got Fingered made money. So it's actually, by Hollywood standards, a huge financial success, something that never gets written. No one ever says that, except for me right now. Obviously, I'm going to say it. But, you know, but that can be frustrating because, you know, it's disingenuous for people to call the movie unsuccessful. And now, 17 years later, and, you know, I literally, not a day goes by where somebody doesn't throw a line from the movie or say, "Daddy, would you like some sausage?" or do the backwards man or X-ray cat or a line from Freddy Got Fingered to me every single day. People don't come up to me with lines from Stealing Harvard.
You know? Do you get Road Trip ever? Do you
Road
get
Trip a little bit. A little bit from Stealing Harvard, a little bit from Road Trip. People say Unleash the Fury and people say I'm Not Liquid John from Stealing Harvard, But I mean, it's just nothing in comparison to Freddy Got Fingered. Freddy Got Fingered is like every single line of the movie people know and gets, you know, because it's such a bizarre and non-traditional film that people, you know, sort of, you know, it's one of those movies that if you like it, you love it. If you don't like it, you either hate it or you haven't seen it.
Or a lot of people hated it, and then now have gone, actually, I respect it, and now I do like it. Like Roger Ebert, right? It was like zero stars when it came out.
Yeah, I honestly don't know if there's people that hated it that now like it. I know Roger Ebert, you know, changed his review or whatever, but I think you instantly loved it or you instantly hated it. But I think that most people who think they hated it never saw it. That's really actually the case. You know, there's going to be some people that saw it that hated it. It was designed to make people hate it. You know, if you're some uptight, you know, old person, you know, who is, you know, conservative and, you know, doesn't want to see somebody swinging a bloody baby around by the umbilical cord in a hospital room, you know, if that doesn't appeal to you, of course you're going to hate the movie. But that's why I was swinging the bloody baby around by the umbilical cord in the hospital room. I was trying to piss people off, you know, but everybody else that you know, you know, most people that see the movie understand that it's completely insane and like it, you know. So I think that was that movie alone single-handedly made me learn to have a complete distrust for the media, because I realized it's all just people writing stuff. The people write the story they want to write. You know, they want to write the story that, you know, that this movie sucks, you know, because it's gross or because it's shocking. So they want to write that. They go into the movie wanting to write that. So there's no way they're going to be able to sit back and relax and laugh at the movie when they're walking into the movie the agenda of destroying it.
Yep.
So, and then they write what they have the agenda of writing. Of course you can obviously sit down and pick it apart and come up with a way to say that it's you know, a bad movie. I mean, it was designed to shock people, right? So, you know,
that's what comedians are meant to do as well, right? Is evoke reactions.
Yeah. Yeah. So, but I honestly, I've sort of grown tired of talking about a lot of this kind of stuff. Not to say, you know, I know we're doing your podcast here and you want to talk about my life and stuff, but you know, I,
your eyes are forward.
Yeah, exactly. I don't want to, you know, I don't plan on spending the next 10 years of my life talking about, you know, the Tom Green Show and Freddie Got Fingered. I like it. I like the fact that it's bringing people out to my shows. I have great fans, but I have talked about this stuff literally now for 15 years, you know.
I can imagine.
And what I love to make clear to people when I do an interview like this is that, you know, my stand-up comedy show right now that I'm doing is funnier than anything I've ever done. If people think that, you know, oh, that I loved the Tom Green Show when I was in college, that was the funniest thing I've ever seen, you know, they should come to my stand-up show. They'll laugh harder. You'll laugh harder at my stand-up show than you would laugh watching Freddie Got Fingered. You know, it's a much more intense experience coming to my stand-up show. It's like Freddie Got Fingered live. You know, without, you know, it's an intense, you know, high energy, ridiculous, absurd comedy show. And because it's live, and because we're all in the same room together, it's a unique experience even for stand-up comedy. I want that to be the headline, you know, next time we do an interview. You know, okay, next time we do an interview, I want you to have been to one of my live shows.
I'm coming tonight.
Yeah, and I want you to talk about the last time you were at my show, and I want to talk for an hour about stand-up comedy.
Let's do it.
Yeah,
perfect. Did you talk about Trump and America and
Yeah, I do politics. Because I was on Celebrity Apprentice.
I know, you were fired by the president.
Yeah, so I do talk about that. I touch on it. I don't go on and on about it because, you know, it's just one thing that I have, like, literally hundreds of subjects I talk about in the show. But you have to talk about it just strictly because I know Trump, and it would be impossible to avoid talking about it given what's going on in the world right now. And, you know, I've had to kind of...
Do you vote? Are you allowed to vote in America as a Canadian?
No, I'm not. I'm not allowed to vote in America because I'm a Canadian. Full on Canadian. So I vote in Canada. I'm not an American citizen.
We each have a green card, do you?
Yeah. Yep. I have no plans to become an American citizen.
Especially not now.
You know, it's not for any dislike of America. Certainly, it's nothing to do with that. I love America. I lived there for 17 years. If I didn't like the country, I wouldn't stay there. I'm proud to be Canadian. You know, it's like, you know, I'm in the United States living there because I'm in entertainment business, and Los Angeles is a good place to be for that. And I'm there, and I do, you know, I have a great home that I've, you know, lived in for the last 15 years, and I don't really. The weather's great, you know. I do love the weather in California. Beats the weather in Ottawa. But it doesn't make me not proud to be a Canadian. I like having my Canadian passport. Yeah.
Marks you out.
Yeah.
Are you a family man?
Well, I don't have any kids.
No.
No.
Is that on the cards for Tom Green?
Possibly, yeah. Possibly. Yeah, it could happen, I'm sure, at some point. I think that I could easily see myself doing that. I'd like to do that, but it's just a matter of... when and how, you know. I mean, I know how. I mean, you know, I know how.
And you still can.
Yes, I can. Yeah, yeah.
Obviously.
Yeah. This is what you're getting at here.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. Because of the testicular cancer. Yeah. They just took the one.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Is reproduction, do you think, the sole purpose why human beings are here?
No. I don't think so.
No.
I think the sole purpose for being here is to enjoy your own life. You know, if reproduction and having a family helps you enjoy your own life, then so be it. Yeah.
Thank you, Tom.
Thank you.
Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Next time we do this, if there will be a next time, I'm up for it if you are.
Yeah.
Then we'll go in on more broad subjects. Now,
yes.
Now we've done Tom Green.
Yeah.
And that's covered. We'll talk about the future and the world.
Absolutely.
And human emotion.
I love that.
Struggle.
Good luck with your show. I think you got a great show here.
Thank you very much.
Yeah.
Thanks for your time.
Congratulations.
Was it okay? I know you went down from stuff that you've covered a lot.
No, it's okay. Yeah. We did, you know, we did it differently.
You didn't hate it?
No, I didn't hate it. I like your jacket.
Thanks, man.
Frank Zappa and the Beastie Boys, Led Zeppelin, The Wizard of Oz, and Pussy Riot, and The Cure.
Thanks, Tom.
High five.
Thank you, dude.
Thank you, everybody. Oh, everybody, go follow me on Instagram. Tom Green on Instagram. Twitter is Tom Green Live, and go to tomgreen.com. Just relaunched the website for mobile devices, and watch some Tom Green show videos from back in the day. Thank you.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight, and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.